I'm going to take you through that 1990s paper because I think it has just helped. It's quite difficult to find. So I'll just sort of give you just the particular finding, which I think is interesting. Just really, I'm going to think if all I can do is just show quite clearly that Beckett is reading case studies and that he's doing things with them and finding analogies between the way he writes and, let's say, the kinds of broken forms of non-storytelling that goes on in, when patients are being prompted to speech. And then I'm going to go to a sort of Cold War example of that, which is more to do with lobotomy patients. But firstly, and I think if you're thinking about when the unnameable, all the words they showed me, there were columns of them, oh, the strange glow, all of a sudden they were on lists with images opposite, I must have forgotten them, I must have mixed them up. These nameless images I have, these images, names, these windows, I should perhaps rather call doors, at least by some other name, and this word man, which is perhaps not the right one for the thing I see when I hear it. So you say there you can see that he's being a kind of patient subject position, being subjected to certain kinds of medical tests. And I think that's one way of seeing it, but also if you think of the kind of writing he does in The Lost Ones, where he adopts the subject position, which is closer to a kind of a cold medical scientific gaze. And I would say that one of the things that Beckett mixes up is the neurobiological scientist and his, her, or her patient, and creates a kind of broken a speech out of that. One of the things, and I think from Murphy onwards, it's clear that Beckett is not only interested in psychoanalytic, let's say, problems in the mind, but also I think what we might call a more Pavlovian idea of the brain as a machine which can be broken and damaged, so that the one of the ways that I think is the 30s Beckett is trying to mix those two incompatibles together. And for instance, I just found a few of the case studies of Edouard Claparède when he's looking at Korsakoff patients. The way that Korsakoff's syndrome, according to Claparède, affects the function of the egocentric connection. In other words, breaks the eye from the not eye. That's what happens when people drink too much, become the Korsakoff syndrome. They get this loss of myself, but also loss of the possibility of representing as though from a self. But the Korsakoff syndrome is also brought on by frontal lobe map damage as well. Okay. So this is one of the things I try to think about is that by mixing up a psychoanalytic and a kind of neurobiological sort of brain damage models, he's at once saying this is a self-destructive thing and also an accident in the way that Catherine Manabou was showed this morning. So moving on to from Claparède, I just found, I think that Pierre Janet, when just looking at hysterical patients, is showing, for instance, that the way that some hysterical syndromes work is as though there was some kind of brain damage. Okay, that the actual shock of an emotional shock can have those kind of effects. I'll just give you just one example: the case of Irène. Pierre Janet saw her at the age of 23, an acute state of hysteria 2 years after her mother's death, suffering from sleepwalking crises and hallucinations. Irène's father was a drunkard, her mother had been a psychotic and had caught tuberculosis when Irène was 20. Irène then had to look after her mother and suffer her mad and cruel demands. Irène went 60 nights with next to no sleep, in constant care for her mother, having to live through ugly, drunken scenes with her father. And in July 1900, her mother died after last days described by Janet as unbelievably dramatic. When Janet began seeing her in early 1901, He witnessed the mind broken in two in the most fearful way. Irène, when she was awake, had no recollection at all of her mother's death. Worse, she refused to acknowledge it even happened. And she had near absolute amnesia of the death. But not only of that, but all of the events surrounding it up to her admittance to hospital. But at night, she went through the sleepwalking ritual, or this terrifying sleepwalking, and lived out an intense, enacted hypermnesia of that tragic night. She would, in these hallucinatory states, relive the events of the night, both acting them out and telling the story. So to just say, when we're talking about perhaps using performance as therapy, it's part of the way that the mind, when broken, will actually fall into kind of formal aesthetic trap like that. So during these dramas, she'd speak in her mother's voice. Irène, ma fille, vaut mieux que tu meurs. It'd be much better if you died. La vie ne fait que commencer pour toi, tu en as déjà trop vu. Life's only just begun for you and you've already seen too much. Right. So Irène is speaking in her mother's voice as well as her own. So there are auditory and visual hallucinations of her mother's face and a voice urging her to suicide. So you have this sleepwalking storytelling reenactment as well as this daytime amnesia. Janet calls this a form of strange, extreme fabulation, fabulation. So fabulation, he theorized, was a kind of memory, but a memory that is sort of developing on its own. Right, on its own. I think this is a clear source for Beckett's footfalls. You have the deep sleep, you have the sleepwalking, you have the hearing of the mother's voice, you have the kind of broken dramatization. Irène is tending her mother while she dies during the reenactment. That's a strong element of Beckett's play. There's a straightening of the pillows, there's the dressing of the sores, of the sponging of the mother down. The storytelling nature of Irène's crise de réminiscence is picked up in this sort of third-person way the story is told, tells how it was. And Amy's vision of her mother as a ghost, she is a pale shade of grey, recalls Irène under hypnosis, who begins to see her mother. I see her shade, I see what she's doing, what she was doing, when she became nasty with me, but I don't see her very well. I think I'll have to compose a head for her. Il faut encore que je lui compose une tête. So this is the composition and it's like a where does drama come from? This comes from this broken, these broken kinds of states, for Beckett anyway. When Amy says, I was not there, that's a kind of tacit allusion to the double personality and the split self. And there are other ways in which I think Janet is haunting Beckett's haunted stage. And it's in a sense, it's saying that writing, for Beckett at least, is a splitting of the mind into two, a denial of personal memory, and then an extreme form of fabulation. So when I think Beckett's writing is picking up on case studies like Janet's Irène, let's say again blur the distinction between the psychoanalytic and the brain damaged ways of thinking. Just to move on to a clearer example of brain damage. As I say, there's this victim doctor. Mélange, which I think creates part of the mess that Beckett wanted to get in the post-war. One of the things I was just looking at was the fact, just a detail in the trilogy, where Malone seems to remember having had a blow on the head before entering into these strange mental states. At the compositional time of the trilogy, we talked earlier about how Sachs sees a struggle between Freudian and more sort of materialist sort of forms of brain science in the mid-century. I mean, I think that's true to the extent that I think a kind of Pavlovian view starts to try and hunt out and supersede sort of soft Freudian readings of mental health. One of the ways that was happening in America, and not only in America, was the development of the uses of lobotomy, psychosurgery, in other words. Egas Monitz gets the Nobel Prize for his use of lobotomy in 1949. So again, this is the time when Beckett's composing the trilogy. And the year before, in 1948, the chief ideologue of transorbital lobotomy, psychosurgeon Walter Freeman, is traveling around the States performing quick operations with his favorite makeshift scalpel, which is a little ice pick, which you push through the eye in order to scrape around in the orbital regions. So 1948... What he used to do is put electrodes on patients' temples, shock them into unconsciousness, peel back an eyelid, and then stab the brains with this ice pick, and repeating the process again and again until the work was done, the aim being to scrape out the frontothalamic nerve fibres that were supposed to harbour the patient's emotional instabilities. I'll just take you through a little bit... At the time, there was a lot of resistance by other scientists to this kinds of psychosurgery, and it was known as a blow on the head, because it was just a fact of bang, that's it, look, that's cured, bang. It was so crude and brutal. And I just say, all this might be lying behind the episode in Malone Dies, when Malone recalls being visited by a strange man who stares at him for a long while before hitting him on the head. The visit. I felt a violent blow on the head. So the visit remains mysterious, despite Malone's attempts to describe the man. But he does add the detail, odd detail, that the man, there was a ruler that seemed to be sticking out of his pocket. And he thinks maybe this is an undertaker, kind of head of schedule. But once he's got the blow on the head, he enters these sort of this strange state. The light has been queer ever since. Oh, I insinuate nothing. Dim and at the same time radiant. Perhaps I have concussion. The attack takes place in the morning, and the man who inflicted it comes back in the afternoon to take stock. And Malone has this very paranoid fear of him and thinks he's going to steal his exercise book, this making him incapable of writing. And then he fears the man's umbrella, oddly. This is the first time he didn't mention it earlier. But he says that he feared he's going to be murdered by its long, sharp point. Right. And he begins to suspect the undertaker's suit that the man wears is some form of disguise, concealing some other, maybe, secret function. But the effect of the blow on the head is debilitating. And my head on fire, full of boiling oil. What shall I die of in the end? A transport of blood to the brain? That would be last straw. The pain is almost unbearable. Upon my soul it is incandescent migraine. Death must take me for someone else. And he begins to lose hearing, the things of the world of this sort of asylum space he's in. And the symptoms worsen, the ceiling rises and falls like a womb wall, there's a sound of falling water, the light leadens, thickens, it starts to eddy, and then Malone's text starts to shrivel, and we end up with Lemuel, the story of Lemuel killing the asylum guards with his hatchet. So my suspicion is that Malone has been subject to a lobotomy, and that the leucotome is being imagined but not grasped metonymically as a ruler, as an umbrella, as a hatchet. And that the Freeman psychosurgeon is similarly disguised as death or death's servant. Picking up on the fact that Freeman was famous for performing his lobotomies in a three-piece suit, and not not with the paraphernalia of the ordinary operating room. Now, if you move into the and there it is that after this lobotomy that we start language starts to break down itself, and then we enter into the unnameable. There are lots of shattered little fragmentary memories of some kind of radical psychosurgical assault on the mind. The unnameable believes that the voices he hears in his head are tempting him to the skull wall. In this way, they'll bring him to the wall and even to the precise point where they have made other holes through which to pass their arms and seize them. How physical all this is. And so this shift from the let's say, psychoanalytic mental to the kind of physical brain is being enacted in the skull fantasy. The actual lobotomy leucotome is there as well, with images of being attacked by these sort of medical staff. They may be trying to get at him with a long pole, perhaps with a hook at the end, and he has a fear of gaffs, hooks, barbs, grapnels, which are like the physical form of the inner tormenting voices which are in his mind as well, including the text, obviously the broken text we're reading. I would just suggest that there is a what happened with Freeman's patients, because he started off in St. Elizabeth's, where there was a famous writer, Ezra Pound, holed up as well. But many of the, let's say, lobotomy patients entered into terminal forms of coma as a result of these interventions. And that St. Elizabeth's, I think, is there in the unnameable's ghost memory of bodies as in deep coma shock, huddled in a heap like him, mute, immovable. And the transorbital side is there in this, and I think everyone remembers the eye motif in the unnameable, this great wild black and white eye, moist, it's to weep with. So the fact that the tears might be liquefied brain is part of the problem, because the whole through has been made there. And there are overt references to coma as mortal inertia in the book. Now, the unnameable doesn't only write from the victim point of view, but also from the psychosurgical point of view. If you remember, there's also the story of the subject circling into the small rotunda, windowless but well furnished with loopholes, in which the last human family is left. That seems to me, and when he arrives, they're killed off, as it were, psychically. So it's not just within the skull, but also the fantasy of being out without the skull. So what's difficult with Beckett is he's not writing just simply from the victim's point of view, but as a form, let's say there's another kind of formality, which is the inbuilt suffering imposed by the medical establishment. From a paranoid point of view.